This morning we looked at various qualifications of those who would be elders from 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. Particularly we noticed qualifications suggesting that an elder must be a mature man, mature in his knowledge of the Word of God, in his practice of it, in his understanding of the nuances of the Christian life. That is, he must not be a novice. He must not be new to the faith, lest he become corrupted by the power and authority that he has as an elder and a shepherd. He must also be a mature and stable family man. And we said this morning that his ability to rule and lead in his family actually is the training ground, if you will, for being an elder. Not so much serving perhaps as a deacon previously, but the measuring stick is how he handles the daily responsibilities of ruling and guiding the home over which he is the head. This evening we're going to look at two other categories of qualifications. As we consider the various things that are given to us by which we evaluate men for this particular role, we must remember, and it's, I think, helpful to remember, that the standards for being shepherds of the flock of God differ vastly from the value systems of this world. When we consider leaders in perhaps business or the military or politicians or in other endeavors of life, it may be that we actually can observe men in roles of leadership in various capacities who actually are not men of character. And when we consider the qualifications for the shepherds of God's people, that's what we're looking at. We said this morning that we can't know the heart of other people. We can't really know the true and inner person when we observe perhaps the outer man in regard to someone else. But what God is doing here is giving us indicators of character, so that when we consider shepherds and leaders among the people of God, we're not looking at those who are charismatic. That is, they are popular and present themselves well and attract other people by a personality. We're not looking for those who are eloquent in their speech, perhaps as a politician has learned to speak and sound bites that can play on the nightly news. We're not looking for a man who promotes himself and advertises his name for recognition among others. And we're not looking for someone who's willing to conform to special interest groups and promises to serve certain of those. And those are oftentimes the kind of people we see leading in the world. And the world is influenced by those who behave in those ways. It is not to be so among the people of God. We are given a yardstick, and the increments along that yardstick are matters of character. God has given these things to help reveal what kind of man an individual is as we consider him for this particular role. So, as we consider these matters, let's think about what it is that's being revealed and take comfort in the fact that God is giving us the true standards by which, as best we can measure other people. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, the term self-controlled is used. Actually, in the King James or New King James, it's temperate. But the idea is self-controlled. That is, a man who is to function in the role of a shepherd must act with, in his life, deliberation and control rather than someone who is impulsive and haphazard. A man who is able to function under the stresses and strains and make the kind of decisions and handle himself properly as he's going to be challenged to do is a man who is calm, who is dispassionate, who is circumspect. He is not a man who is simply led by his emotions or responds to the intensity of the situation before him. Impulsiveness can destroy relationships We perhaps can see that in certain things that we've done in our own lives, mistakes that we've made, things that we've said, because we were overcome by emotion. And we might say later, I didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean to say that. I lost control of myself. I said things that I regret saying and really didn't want to handle myself in that way. And relationships can be destroyed and premature decisions can be made because of response to emotional stimuli. A man who serves as a shepherd of God's people must be able to be in control of his passions, in control of his emotions, able to evaluate a situation properly on balanced grounds and respond in appropriate ways. Does this man, perhaps as we're considering someone for this role, does this man live a well-ordered life? Does this man live in financial disarray? Is he able to control his financial income, his spending habits? Can he control his emotions? Is he trivial? Is he shallow about things? Or does he manifest a deeper understanding of spiritual issues and thus comports himself according to spiritual principles? Is his life dominated by things around him? Or does he himself keep himself in control relative to his environment? Also in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2, the term sober-minded is found. And it seems to me, as I've studied through some of these particular qualifications, some of them seem to be fairly synonymous. There may be some subtle differences, and there may be some differences that I can't explain as clearly as I would like to. But some of them are almost parallel. Perhaps these two would come to mind. Self-controlled and sober-minded. At least they seem to be dependent upon each other. An elder must be sound in mind. He must be balanced. His deliberations must be governed by reasoned analysis rather than emotional reactions. He must be able to discern arguments. We talked about that some relative, especially to false teaching this morning. He must be able to identify the motives of the unscrupulous. He's going to be faced with that in various situations. He must be able to lay out, and they collectively, and oftentimes when I speak in the singular, I'm referring to the collective. He must be able to lay out a remedial or a corrective course of action that has the best chance of accomplishing a spiritual end. That is, a problem has arisen. An elder and the elders together must be able to analyze it properly, understand its nuances, be able to see where the evil and the wickedness in that situation lies, or the danger or the threat lies, and be able to map out a course for an individual or for the congregation to follow that has, as I said, the best chance of succeeding or accomplishing a spiritual end. Elders are not infallible. I haven't seen that yet in the qualifications. They're not infallible. And sometimes the best you can do is give other people guidance and direction that when, if followed, would have a good result. But again, the elders do not have a police force to force a particular course of action. And others can reject the guidance and the advice and the direction given. And all elders can do is correctly analyze the situation, work out the correct way forward, the procedure upon which an individual of the congregation may go, and urge and teach and support that conclusion. And if followed by prayer, by the providence of God, and by good people trying to do well, the end that is desired may turn out. Also, I think involved in being sober-minded is the ability to have resolve and some degree of self-certainty in the face of criticism. A sober-minded man is going to be able to evaluate criticism made of him or the elders as a whole, or perhaps of others, but for now, I'm referring particularly to the stress that's going to come upon a man and the questions about himself that may arise because of the reactions of others. A flighty, uncertain, vacillating, and reactionary man is unsuited to the pressures and the judgments that must be made by elders. And I think that's all connected with the idea of being sober-minded, being clear and stable in one's thinking and in one's evaluation of circumstances around him. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3, also in Titus chapter 1 and verse 7, we have these qualifications listed. I don't know if I said this a moment ago, but these are elements of temperament, talking about how a man handles himself and views himself and behaves under pressure. We're told that those who are elders must not be violent, nor quarrelsome, and not quick-tempered. And I think the reasons for these qualifications should be fairly obvious. Elders are going to be asked to deal with very volatile situations. There are things that are going to be very delicate, things that involve perhaps the brethren being at odds, matters that require much wisdom and careful handling and decorum and control, as we've already seen. But if there is a tendency to be quick-tempered, then the pressures and the stresses that are going to have to be faced are going to set those things off, because the pressures are enormous. Elders are going to suffer abuse at times. Their judgments are going to be resisted. They're going to have criticism directed their way. It may be also at times that elders might disagree with each other in regard to various judgments about what should be done and what that best way forward may be in a given set of circumstances. And so, first and foremost, there must be the ability to control oneself, to handle oneself maturely, as the elders themselves are dealing with very pressure-packed issues. You know, you can stand up here and talk about this, and you can try to impress that upon people, but it is not until you sit perhaps in a closed-up room with a very powerful moral issue being discussed, perhaps issues of criminal behavior, which I have seen be dealt with in a local church, and you see families of those who are involved becoming very volatile and very emotional and beginning to turn against the elders and turn against the church. It's not until you face that do you realize how important these qualifications are. It might be that you're sitting there thinking that I'm sort of overstating the case, and I really don't think I am. There are enormous pressures and challenges and threats to a man's emotional and spiritual well-being and his view of himself and how he identifies himself, how he handles himself in some very extreme circumstances. And if there is a man who is thrust into that role and he does not have these qualities, especially if he is prone to biting back and criticizing in return and putting down and insulting and perhaps even being pugnacious, then he's not qualified to serve in this particular role. A man who takes personal offense easily, who is harsh and demeaning to others, who responds first sharply and critically, who is even perhaps bullying and intimidating and threatening, cannot serve as an elder. As we made mention of this morning, these traits, like some others, are usually not going to be observed at worship services. We all try to handle ourselves especially well when we come before our brethren. We want to put on our good side physically and as well as our demeanor and how we behave. It's when you are with a man socially and recreationally that you will see perhaps his true colors come out. That's happened on occasion in my life where I have been with a particular brother. One instance comes to mind. I haven't been here very long. I may have already told this story. You know, you lose track. But I was with a brother one time at a golf tournament, and he just cut loose with some profanities like I have never heard. And I was just stunned at what happened and how he behaved himself. I'm fairly certain I never would have seen that at worship services. And so we need to know each other. We need to spend time together. We need to see what we're really like outside of circumstances where we're on our best behavior. Not self-willed is a qualification mentioned in Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. The fact that elders do have authority and they have rule and their influence can be significant makes not being self-willed particularly important. There's a delicate balance between advising in matters of wisdom and imposing one's personal views on others. When an elder, perhaps, or the elders together, see danger or drifting in an individual's life or the congregation, they might be overcome with zeal for what is right and respond in a heavy-handed way. It's very tempting because we want people to do well and we want righteousness to be upheld and we want others to be godly and we want them to go in the proper direction. Sometimes, elder or not, it's very tempting to exert pressure on others, perhaps in an unacceptable way, to try to persuade them to do what is right. And I think this is a particular danger for elders who have authority and rule. Further, I think an older elder might find it very tempting to preempt or to exert himself over a younger elder, perhaps thinking that by virtue of his years of service, he is wiser. I think that'd be a strong temptation for a man who served for a long time as an elder, perhaps with one who is a little less experienced in that role, who comes along. And a danger of being too assertive or self-willed certainly exists. We've mentioned this before relative to the role of elders in regard to their being shepherds, but I'll repeat it again. An elder must distinguish between truly leading the sheep and trying to drive them by his personal will. And that is what leads to being lords over the flock rather than shepherds, as Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 5 in verse 3. Someone recently had this illustration. I thought it was very good. It's very difficult to push a rope. You have to pull one. And elders must be out leading and in exhorting and setting an example and teaching. We've said that's the moral authority they have, teaching and urging and pleading. But cracking the whip, as it were, is sort of like trying to push the rope. And it may be that not only is it ineffective, but counterproductive. Well, elements of temperament, self-controlled, sober-minded, not violent, not quarrelsome, not quick-tempered, not self-willed. There are some other qualifications given that I think are, in principle, elements of moral purity. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 8, Paul is writing there to Titus and says, those who are appointed must be, in the singular, a lover of what is good and holy. The first thing to notice, I think, about this qualification is its positive structure. That is, it doesn't say that an elder simply must not be bad. And this reminds me of what Jesus teaches, as we sometimes call the golden rule, Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12. Whatever you want someone to do for you, you do it for them. And Jesus turns it into a positive command. We should be actively seeking to do good, not simply withholding bad behavior from others because we wouldn't want others to do it to us. In this particular qualification, a man must be a lover of what is good. Not just casually interested or pleased if something good happens, but a lover of what is good. Not someone occasionally concerned about things that are good. This is the man who desires a good and holy outcome, who works to see that it is accomplished. He will support that which is good with the resources of the local church, both monetarily in terms of its energy and manpower. This is a man who is diligent about having a good effect and a good outcome. And it might be that there are some men who are simply content to sit back and try to make sure nothing bad happens in the congregation. And certainly elders must do that. They must strive to be overseers and to watch out for the potential for bad things to happen. But this is a positive exhortation here. They must love what is good and be holy and pursue goodness in all of its aspects. I think Paul here is talking about one who is intensely, unequivocally, uncompromisingly, genuinely committed to and supportive of good things. This is a man of singular devotion to holiness and godliness. He does not present dubious or doubtful disposition as to his goodness. We all know people like that. We all know people that we might say, he doesn't have a wicked bone in his body. Everything about that man, or even everything about that woman, suggests that they're wholly committed to what is good. You don't see behavior, you don't hear speech from them that makes you wonder where they're really coming from. This is a person that is genuine and deep in their godliness. This is not masked morality, that is, putting on a front. It is not for image or for show, but simply, this is the person who is good because that's what he is. And that is a lover of what is good, not merely someone who rejoices in good that happens, though that certainly would be a part of it. Not given to wine. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3, Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. The idea here is one who, in the original term here, lingers at or tarries at drinking wine until he becomes influenced by its alcoholic effects. The idea, I think specifically here, is not how long or in what quantities one drinks alcohol. The idea is not to be impaired at all by the effects of alcohol. Now, this is one I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail. I'm going to do it from a particular point of view, and here's the reason why. It seems to me, and I think it seems so to other men that I have talked to in various places, that there is a growing tendency among the people of God to advocate social drinking. And I'm not going to turn this part of the lesson into a treatise on social drinking. I don't have the time to do it, but I do think we need to stop here and say some things about that particular subject. It seems to me to be a total corruption of the Scriptures to take a qualification that is for a man who should be the epitome of spirituality, who should be in total possession of his faculties, as we've talked about on the left side of the screen. A man who is self-controlled and sober-minded and not violent and quarrelsome and quick-tempered, not self-willed. A man who has grown and matured and understands the nuances of spirituality, who's lived and developed himself in Christian virtue and character. To now take one of the qualifications for a man like that and try to justify social drinking from it. I find that unfathomable. And yet that's what happens with this qualification. Some people say not given to wine, not addicted to wine, actually is one of the translations. And the reasoning becomes, well, it's okay to drink socially. It's okay to perhaps at a restaurant or in the privacy of one's home to engage in drinking of wine or other drinks, so long as he doesn't tarry long at it, so long as one doesn't become unduly, perhaps, affected by alcohol. I'm going to address this from two points of view that I admit, first of all, have to do with effect, and secondly, they have to do with analogy. We're not going to go into the meaning of oinos. We're not going to go into Greek terms of wine and drunkenness and whatnot. I'm only going to throw some things out for consideration on a very practical basis. Because to me, on the face of it, this is something that can be answered in a very practical sense. What I want us to think about, and let me say, I don't know who here may or may not hold such a view. In fact, perhaps it's advantageous that I've not been here very long and I've been charged with doing this series of lessons, because I'm not preaching about personalities. I'm not preaching about individuals. I'm not preaching about the current eldership that we have. I'm not preaching about a perspective elder that may be here. I don't know this congregation well enough to do that, which frees me up. to be able to speak what is in my mind and in my heart, what I think is from the Scriptures, without it being confused with attacking someone personally. Having said that, let me just ask the question. Is this where we really want to go? Do we really want to go down this path of arguing that a Christian can drink socially, a Christian can imbibe in alcoholic beverages to the extent that drinks today are infused with alcohol? Do we want to argue that it's okay for a Christian to do that and accept where that's going to take us? Because you know, if that's where you're going to go, you're not going to be able to stop the train. And what I mean by that is if you're going to advocate, or if anybody's going to advocate, that it's okay to drink without getting drunk, and we'll talk about what that means in just a moment, you're also going to have to give someone else the latitude. Elders. The latitude to take a drink before they come to an elders' meeting. You're going to have to give the preacher latitude to take a drink before he preaches because of the kind of stress in preaching lessons like this. How far do you want to go down this path? And I suspect that what brethren want to do is they want to go far enough down the path to justify their own practice. And then somewhere they're going to want to draw a line and say, oh yeah, but you can't go that far with it. Why, of course an elder can't take a drink before he goes into an elder's meeting. What would you think? What would you think about an elder that came to a meeting with you and you smelled alcohol on his breath? And you say, Brother Smith, is that alcohol I smell on your breath? And Brother Smith says, oh, I just had a little drink to calm my nerves before this meeting. I'm not drunk. Is that acceptable? In conversation with me or Sewell Hall or any preacher after a sermon and you smelled alcohol in the preacher's breath, do you think that would be acceptable? If my reason for having alcohol in my breath was simply I didn't have very much, do you think that would be acceptable? How far down this path do you want to go? I also want to share some other thoughts with you that are just very practical. Just the practical outcomes of accepting that kind of reasoning. One comes from, if you haven't seen one of these, a driver's manual for the state of Georgia. And what I simply want you to think about is, where are we going to draw this line of being unacceptably affected by alcohol? Where are we going to draw that line? There's something I learned in this particular book that I did not know before. You may not know it, unless you've taken a driving test recently. On page 45 of this book, the law reads, a person 21 or more years of age is considered under the influence of intoxicants when 0.08 grams or more by alcohol weight is present in his blood. So what this is saying is, if you are 21, you're considered drunk if your blood alcohol level is 0.08%, it says, by alcohol weight. But that's not all the law. You probably knew that part. A person under 21 years of age is considered under the influence of intoxicants when 0.02% or grams or more by alcohol weight is present in the blood. So what we're being told here is our law, which is probably in large measure determined by people that drink alcohol, the law recognizes this level of alcohol, 0.2%, as being under the influence of alcohol in someone under 21 years of age. Now, there's another page in this book, page 60, and this is a chart that has to do with what certain percentages of alcohol do to you when you're under its influence. And what it says is, if you have 0.3%, these are, in case you've forgotten like me, some of your math, tens and hundredths, 1/100th of a gram by alcohol weight over that limit, 0.3, you already experience slowed reactions. If you're at 0.5, which is still under the legal drunk limit for operating motor vehicle, 0.5, people start already demonstrating increased risk-taking. That is, their judgment begins to go wrong. 0.8, which is the legal limit, impaired vision. And then 0.10%, which used to be the basic standard, but states are beginning to lower that to 0.8. But if it's 0.1%, you're demonstrating poor coordination. So as we perhaps consider this matter of what is under the influence and how much does it take and how many drinks, how many beers, how much wine to actually begin to affect me to the point of intoxication, where are we going to draw that line? And here are the politicians, most of whom I submit are drinkers. Here are the politicians, and they're shaving this very fine. But I'm going to tell you what. Compared to any of my brethren who would argue that you can drink socially and it's acceptable to God, the world, I think, has stricter standards relative to the law and operating a motor vehicle about it. Also in the paper last week, just by way of analogy, there was an article in the sports page on NASCAR drivers relative to drug use and alcohol use. And I'm going to read just a couple of portions of that article. There's no doubt in my mind, the article says, and this is, by the way, this is NASCAR Vice President Jim Hunter speaking. There's no doubt in my mind that in the old days, people would have a few pops and then drive a race car. But it would be totally unacceptable today if a guy even admitted drinking a beer before a race. On race day, competitors are prohibited from consuming any alcohol prior to the event or being under the influence of alcohol above 0.2%. The standard for someone under 21 years of age to be considered under the influence of alcohol. Let me read that again. On race day, competitors are prohibited from consuming any alcohol prior to the event or being under the influence of alcohol above 0.02 blood alcohol level. Most state DUI laws place 0.08 as a threshold for intoxication. Another observation made by the president of NASCAR, Mike Helton. He said, NASCAR's efforts to police substance abuse are aided by drivers and others in the garage, listen to this, who realize that racing is inherently dangerous and that an impaired driver puts not only himself but other drivers and pit crew members at risk. The competitors understand that they don't need to be in the car with any type of level of anything that deters them from top performance, and they don't want others to be impaired either. What is my point? Does NASCAR understand something that maybe perhaps some of my brethren don't understand? How can you argue the danger of driving a race car under any influence of alcohol and then say it would be okay for an elder to make certain decisions with alcohol in his bloodstream, when those decisions are worse than life and death when it comes to NASCAR racing or any other motor racing? The decisions they might be called upon to make are eternal decisions. Again, I grant, I'm just arguing here from the standpoint of practicality. Does this even make sense to anybody? Does it make sense that the world is placing all of these restrictions on men operating motor vehicles on the road or race cars on a racetrack And they realize how detrimental and how damaging the effects of alcohol can be. And yet, some of my brethren might turn around and argue that a Christian, in trying to make moral and spiritual judgments, in trying to exercise self-control, in trying to be in possession of his body and his mind, and realize the approach of temptation and have the resolve and the wherewithal to resist temptation, that it would be okay for a Christian to be under those effects? When the world realizes that you lose your ability to make judgments under the effects of alcohol? An elder is to be the epitome of self-control, goodness, patience, a yielding spirit. And it's wholly incompatible with all of that to ingest chemicals that would tear all that down, as it would be, in my opinion, for any Christian to do so. Jesus makes an observation that I think in principle applies. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 8, he says, "The sons of this age are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light." Sometimes the world understands things better than we do. Sometimes the world is ahead of us in immorality. But it might be that in some other things, the world's ahead of us in realizing some dangers that we in our naivete do not realize. And I think this is one area where that may be so. We should be the most spiritually aware and attuned and morally sharp people on the face of the earth, because of what we know from the mind of God. How any brethren can argue that we can participate in behavior that the world, even now the beer companies are starting to have commercials on TV about what a danger it is to use their products. And I'm telling you, they're not doing that to be benevolent. They're trying to avoid lawsuits. But even they will now come out and admit, as will tobacco companies, our products will hurt you or kill you. And it's taken the threat of lawsuits to get them to admit it. Might it not be that the world is ahead of some of our brethren in this regard to understand the perhaps mortal dangers that are involved in drinking alcohol? An elder must not be greedy for money. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3, also Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. Wealthy and greedy are not synonymous terms. A man may be wealthy, but it's not by greed. It may be by his education. It may be by his choice of vocation. He may be wealthy by inheritance or just dumb luck. So to be wealthy is not necessarily to be greedy. An impoverished man might be consumed with greed. But a man who works, perhaps to the neglect of his family, who lives beyond his means and is continually pressuring his family with debt, who manifests a lack of contentment with what he has, is not qualified to oversee spiritual things. That may be for a lot of reasons. And with any of these qualifications, we might speculate, because there's often not an explanation given as to why that's a valuable qualification to have. But greed may cause an elder to neglect his spiritual duties in pursuit of acquisition of things, paying more attention to his investments than to the spiritual needs that are before him. Or he may be negatively influenced in the responsible disbursement of congregational funds. And this, I think, goes back to our earlier observation that he must be a lover of what is good, promoting, actively promoting good and righteous and godly ends, rather than a man who's stingy and wants to hold on and hang on rather than expend for the sake of the Lord. And that may be part of why this particular qualification is here. As we close, some of these qualities may be very difficult to evaluate in certain individuals. It may be that we don't know each other as well as we should. It may be that someone is trying to hide certain uncomplimentary characteristics. They may be very subtle. And the one we just mentioned, greed, I think is a very difficult thing to determine in the life of another person. And it requires care. It requires prayerful examination and fairness of thought. And an understanding, perhaps, of a man over a period of time to be able to identify whether one is greedy. I do know this. The qualification is there. It's there. And it must be there for a reason. And it must, we must be able to determine it somehow, though it may be difficult in a given case. The Lord included it. He wanted us to consider that. And we live in an age where perhaps it might be very easy to be overcome by greed and material things. But these things are difficult sometimes to evaluate properly. And we said this morning that this particular process that we're involved in can be very volatile and can be very difficult. And it's going to require, I think, everybody in the congregation here reaching deep within their soul and to behave properly and have the right attitudes toward others as perhaps some very delicate and difficult matters are going to be discussed. One of the benefits of truly being a family and truly knowing each other intimately is the ability to make these kinds of judgments when so much is at stake. And again, it's very difficult to try to establish at the last minute if we've not been close, if we've not really been involved in the lives of each other. It's not something you can make up for in a short period of time with what is at stake. But anyway, I hope that our thoughts together today and throughout all these lessons are helping at least to clarify in our minds what this role is about, what the duties are, what the rule and the authority is, and what we should actually be measuring. Again, it's not a popularity contest, it's a character contest. Contest being used loosely. And the Lord gives us the measuring standard by which we can do our best to make the right judgments and pray for His providence and His will to be done. A song has been selected to invite you to come forward and express whatever spiritual need that you may have. And certainly we, before we dismiss, would love to be of service to anybody here desirous to respond to the Lord. If we can help you, would you come as we stand and sing?